Hey there, Vermont Edition listeners. Hope you got a stack of pancakes because we have sugared off this episode until it's short and sweet. I'm Vermont Edition producer Andrea Lorien, and I hope you enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. You might be able to tell from our music that it is Halloween, and we are very excited about it here. Today, we are exploring all things spooky and creepy. Later in the show, we'll talk with a real-life Ghostbuster, and Jane Lindholm will join us after that. The latest episode of her podcast for curious kids, But Why, is all about that feeling of being scared, and why some of us like it and others definitely don't. But first, many Vermonters have heard of Champ, our beloved monster lurking in Lake Champlain. What else is prowling nearby? Our first guest can help us understand what other creatures are rumored to be out there. Lauren Coleman from Bangor, Maine, is the founder and director of the International Cryptozoology Museum in Portland. It contains 5 decades worth of cryptozoological artifacts and items he's collected. He's a world-renowned expert in the field and the author of several books on cryptozoology. Lauren, welcome.
Oh, I'm glad to be here. Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween to you, too. Now, Lauren, I just said the phrase cryptozoology multiple times without tripping over it. I'm very proud of myself. What exactly is cryptozoology?
That was excellent.
Thank you.
Actually, cryptozoology is the study of hidden or unknown animals. The whole object of cryptozoology is to gather folklore, traditions, evidence and physical evidence to look for new species in zoology.
Physical evidence. What is out there?
Well, there's all kinds of things. There's footprints, foot casts, there's fecal material, there's scratch marks on trees. As far as the Loch Ness Monster or Champ, we have to look for sonar and other kinds of evidence, of course, that's in the water. Although there have been reports of these creatures being seen on land. So we're looking for traces too.
Wait, there's evidence of Champ coming up on land? Not just at Lake Monsters baseball games?
Well, there's many more sightings of the Loch Ness Monster. There's about 70 of them on land. It's much less likely that Champ has been seen on land, although we're open-minded enough to listen to everybody's stories.
Well, Lauren, first, how did you get interested in this field of study?
Well, my background, my formal background when I finally went to college was in zoology and anthropology. But the way I got there and my interest in cryptozoology came first because I was watching a former documentary filmmaker who was making one of his first science fiction films, and it was called Half Human by Ishiro Honda, who actually is much more famous for his films than he made after Half Human, which was Godzilla. And so that film was about the abominable snowmen, these creatures in the mountains of Asia. I went to school the next week and I said to my teachers, what is this about the Yeti? And they gave me 3 answers. They don't exist. Get back to your homework. Leave me alone. So, of course, I became very curious what was going on here. And I started investigating, started interviewing. I was living in Illinois at the time and there were lots of reports of little hairy creatures as well as mystery cats and giant snakes. And things that really didn't fit in the zoology books. So I started investigating those. And before I knew it, I had 400 correspondents. And I was traveling, hitchhiking, usually all over the Midwest before I went to college at Southern Illinois University.
So you were hitchhiking across the Midwest trying to find more evidence of these creatures?
Well, back then, there wasn't any internet. There wasn't even any email. So there was an informal network of correspondents, and we would exchange little fillers that we'd find in newspaper articles that would hint at sightings, at mystery animals being, encountered. And then I would try to track them down. I would hitchhike. I would get rides. I would get share rides, whatever it would take. End up in Mississippi in 48 hours and be looking into those creatures, talking to local law enforcement folks, going to there were no tourist stops back then. What we would go to would be gas stations. And we'd say, what do you know about such and such around here? And they'd say, well, there's no mystery cats around here, but there's a giant turtle down the road. So I'd look into that. And it was lots of fun.
Oh my gosh. What a series of adventures that must have been. Let's go first to Rolf in Brattleboro. Rolf, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello. Just wanted to let all Vermonters know that from the Brattle Memorial Library, people can check out on interlibrary loan a small figurine that we call the Green Mountain Tiny Foot, which is a small figurine that can be posed and photographed so that people can create their very own fake photos of our own Green Mountain Tiny Foot Sasquatch.
Oh, I love that. So you can put it out in the woods and you can create your own photos and maybe trick someone?
Well, we're more about laughing with people, sure. Not so much tricking people.
Well, it's Halloween, so I'm thinking tricks or treats.
I'd say treats.
Okay. Well, that's great to know about, Rob. Thank you so much. Lauren, have you ever come across any photos like this or somebody trying to submit a photo that is very obviously using a prop like the tiny foot in Brattleboro?
Actually, I have. I've investigated enough places all over the country and people have put taxidermy kangaroos in yards and photographed them and then talked to their local media or, newspaper and tried to get them in the paper. Because that's what people try to do who are hoaxing. They're trying to get attention. So, yes, I couldn't understand a word the person had said. The connection was really bad. Sounded like a monster to me. But
you'll have to investigate.
But it sounds like that if that's what he was talking about, yes, it does happen. And I've seen it.
Well, the caller did bring up Bigfoot, so let's pause there for a moment. Any Bigfoot sightings in Vermont or the surrounding region?
Is that question for me?
That's for you.
Yes, there are quite a bit. You have even one of the most famous anthropologists in the world, Carlton Coon, who was out of Harvard and the University of Pennsylvania, came up to southern New Hampshire and then a little bit over to Vermont to investigate some cases there. I've actually traveled all over New England, even went to Lake Champlain with a Japanese expedition looking for Champ, but definitely ran into many different Bigfoot encounters. It's not as populated, it seems, as the Pacific Northwest, but there are some good cases.
What other sightings are in our region?
Well, one of the most populous, most frequent sightings of a mystery animal happens to be the Black Panthers. And Black Panthers are seen especially all over Vermont, and especially in the Northeast Kingdom. And of course, up in the Northeast Kingdom, you have lake monsters. Several of the lakes in Quebec and northern Vermont have those sightings too. But I'd say mystery cats are probably the one that has the most people scratching their heads. In addition to that, people think that there's lots of mountain lions in the state. So they really get confused with the mystery cats too, because they take it for granted that all of these black panthers and mountain lions and things like that are around and that most wildlife biologists know about them. But what is perplexing is that most of the wildlife biologists in the state of Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine will tell you that they don't exist here, so people must be mistaken. Luckily, there's enough cryptozoologists now around that people are listening to some of the eyewitnesses seriously.
So tell me more about this. Let's get into this beef with the wildlife biologists and maybe some government fish and wildlife departments as well. So people will call in and say, hey, I saw this big cat. I think it's one thing. And wildlife biologists say, no, it's something else. But you're out there saying, oh, let's listen to what people are saying or are taking photos of and believe them. What kind of evidence do you have, though, to back up those claims?
And let's look at the footprints, too, because we have been footprints found even in Cape Elizabeth in Maine. There was a cub and its mother seen. I know what the wildlife biologists have to put up with. They really think about public safety. And so their first real opinion is that somebody's seen a black Angus calf or a black lab. And so they want to put all of these stories to rest because they don't want panic. It's very similar to how UFOs were treated in the 1940s. Everybody thought that there was going to be reports of aliens from outer space. And so all the officials tried to calm everybody down with the most logical, skeptical position. And you see this over and over again with the giant snakes, the Bigfoot, the Black Panthers. And we really understand that. You know, most of us in cryptozoology are from a pretty straightforward scientific background. And I, too, am looking for the most logical, skeptical explanation. But like you mentioned, and like I mentioned, it's always good to listen to people first before jumping to conclusions.
Okay, well, I was just listening closely to that description, Lauren, and you mentioned giant snakes. Can we go back to that? What snakes are you talking about, and are they close to me?
Are they close to you?
Well, yes. <that's not. laughs> Now I'm scared.
Well, the most recent big flap that we have, as we call them, was a couple years ago in Westbrook, Maine. There were reports of a 10.5-12-foot long snake that was reported, and nobody would believe it was seen on a playground. It was seen near a river, and it kept being disputed by the local officials. And then all of a sudden, two police officers saw it swimming across the river here with a pig in its mouth. So they changed their mind, and there all of a sudden was huge man hunts and women hunts looking for this giant snake. And then so happens in the summer, the police officers found a giant snake skin wrapped around a tree in a park near Westbrook. And it was analyzed by some herpetologists at the University of Texas, and it was positively identified as a female anaconda from the Andes. So that tells us it probably was an escaped pet. But the thing is that that kind of pet, the anaconda, is not supposed to be in the pet trade in Maine.
Absolutely not.
Especially one that large. So there have been reports now and then from each of the New England states of large snakes being seen, sometimes unidentified. Even in the Ware River of Massachusetts, there's alligator reports. So, and they aren't supposed to be up north, that's for sure. Mm. So part of cryptozoology is the study of out-of-place animals. So we're looking at those and tracking those. Unfortunately, people have to realize that climate change is very real. And I, for years, have been tracking people in even as far north as Buffalo, New York, telling me they were seeing armadillos. and armadillos were way out of range because they're spreading all over the country. And so we try, one of the side benefits of cryptozoology then is we're helping a climate control scientist track some of these animals too.
So it seems like you're part sociologist or anthropologist, part wildlife biologist, and part detective.
Well, that's so true. I actually have an undergraduate degree in anthropology and zoology and a master's degree in psychiatric social work. So I can understand all parts of the human being trying to give me different reports. And then I've written over 100 books. So some of them are now seen as part of folklore, too.
Wow. Well, Lauren, before we let you go, tell us a little bit more about your museum. What are some of the artifacts that people can see if they visit in Portland?
Sure. In Portland, and we're actually expanding to Bangor, Maine, where we're renovating a Art Deco building right now. So we have a life-size Bigfoot, 8.5 foot tall. We've got a life-size sea serpent and a life-size gill man, because we do appreciate some of the folklore. And so we also have artifacts. We have 20,000 artifacts in the museum, and they come from a lot of investigations. A lot of the people who have found things as they're looking for these creatures. One of our newest things is a 6.5 foot long life-size giant salamander that's been reported for over 50 years in the Trinity Alps of Northern California, very similar to the giant salamanders of Japan and China. So some of the things are extremely interesting for people to look at, and they can't quite believe their eyes when they come in.
Wow. Well, I, for one, cannot wait to visit. Lauren Coleman, the founder and director of the International Cryptozoology Museum, currently in Portland, though it sounds like you're expanding, which is very exciting as well. Lauren, thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure. It's been great to be here. And happy Halloween again.
You as well. Ghosts. Are you a believer? Or maybe you just like a good ghost story on Halloween. Lindsay Stevens of Rutland is very much a believer. She's an investigator with the Paranormal Investigators of New England. They look into hauntings, UFO sightings, cryptozoology, and other unexplained activity. This last weekend, the group investigated the Wilson Castle in Proctor. Welcome.
Hello. Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween to you, too. Okay, Lindsay, a paranormal investigator, what is that?
So, like you just said, we investigate everything, whether it's paranormal related, cryptozoology, UFOs. You know, I've been a member with the team for about 10 years. So in that 10 years, I have investigated everything and anything.
Really?
So, you know, I mean, where do you want to start?
Okay. First, tell me how you got into this line of work. And is this your day job?
No. So every member of our team actually has their, you know, day jobs. So this is all something that we do on the side. It's all volunteer work. So we never charge for a case or anything like that. I'm actually an administrator during the daytime and then a ghost hunter at nighttime.
All right. So let's talk through some of the things that you've investigated. Now, I mentioned that just last weekend you were at Wilson Castle in Proctor. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So I actually was not on that investigation. Okay. The rest of the team did. But because I'm so local to the Wilson's Castle, of course, I have investigated it in the past. It's a super cool place. You know, like the inside, besides the like the paranormal, you know, it's just a cool historic place, like the, you know, building itself. And come on, a castle in Vermont? Like, who wouldn't want to investigate it? So there's a lot of, you know, creepy, eerie things that happen there. Just the noises and, you know, seeing shadows darting back and forth. And they don't have cats there. They don't have dogs there. So what is it?
What is it? Did they find anything?
So I have not seen the evidence yet. They are still reviewing. So in any case that we do, there are hours of just evidence to comb through, because you have to think, anything that we do, we have videos that we're capturing, and you know, each house we may have 6-7 videos set up in each room, so you're thinking hours of, you know, video footage to go through. We have recordings, so we should be getting the evidence reel here here real soon.
All right. Well, tell us, okay, since you don't have evidence from Wilson Castle just yet, what is a investigation that you've been a part of recently where you feel like you found, you know, some really good material that you can point to and say, hey, something was here?
Okay. So what I'm going to say is I'm going to tell you one of the famous places because it is absolutely awesome is the Conjuring House. I have gone on hundreds of investigations, whether it's privately, you know, locally, or some big name, you know, well-known paranormal hotspot. Out of everything, every place I've been to, the Conjuring House was definitely the biggest experience. We caught so much evidence there and so much clear evidence, too, at that. So when we go into an investigation, we always try to be, you know, scientifically driven, but we also have a medium on our team as well. So now in recent years, we've started working side by side with the medium and then our, you know, our equipment too, because if you get two things, you know, it's bigger evidence. And so the last time I was there, I was sitting on the couch and I was like, you know, I just was creeped out all of a sudden. You know, we were just sitting there having a conversation, so creeped out all of a sudden. And I was like, I literally feel like somebody is standing behind me. And I asked the psychic on our team, I was like, do you see anything? Are you picking up on anything? And so she also had the SLS cam, which is like a camera that picks up stick figures. So she was shining that on me. And at the same time, a stick figure popped up in the camera. And at the same time as that happened, something moved my hair and grabbed the tag of my shirt. I jumped up out of my seat, and I've been touched before, but I jumped out of my seat so quick. But then it gets better. So then we were reviewing evidence, and as we were reviewing the evidence, we captured an EVP at the same moment that, you know, the other two pieces of evidence were captured. And it said, and this was clear as day, I'm going to get you.
Oh, my gosh.
And I was like, you know, I said to my other member of the team, I was like, if we heard that with our own ears at that time, I think I would have ran out of the house.
Wow. Oh, my
so
gosh.
So that was, it was such a creepy location. So much activity there. I mean, the evidence just went on and on. So if anybody ever wants to visit a famous place or a well-known, you know, place, visit the Conjuring House. You will not be disappointed.
Oh my gosh, I would have screamed my head off.
Oh.
Well, let's go to the phones. We have a bunch of callers with stories of their own,
ooh,
it sounds like. Joshua in Windham first. Joshua, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I lived on Elm Street in Brattleboro. It's the first place I moved out of my parents' house. I was about 17 to 18 when I lived there. And when I was living there, I had like weird dreams. It was a weird house. It was like there was a weird energy there. And I found out that there was multiple mob murders from the dog racing track in Hinsdale.
Ooh.
That they boarded up bodies in the basement. And most disturbingly, a few years after the bodies were boarded up, there was another murder that happened involving the Hinsdale dog racing track again, when two sons and their mother stole a bunch of money and they had to fight over the money. And the mother ran up the stairs right to where my room was, and she fell down the stairs and was killed by her sons at the bottom. And so some nights I would just hear thump, 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 somebody running up the stairs and boom, 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 of them falling back down. And it was like a, you know, a repeated thing that happened, like, you know, week in, week out, you know.
Ooh, very spooky. I'm curious about one element of this story. Lindsay, how often do you hear reports of possible ghosts or paranormal activity in a place where a violent crime has occurred?
I mean, yeah, it's definitely a very common thing. So another thing, too, that I would be interested in if I could ever get into that house and investigate myself, it would be, you know, whether it's something residual, which is, you know, like something that's imprinted on that house. There's obviously been a lot of negative energy at that house. So was that sound that he, since he was continuously hearing it, you know, night after night, was that just some residual energy that's stuck and implanted, you know, in that home? Or is there something actually intelligent there that's causing, you know, the haunting or, you know, these reports?
Or a raccoon.
Could be a raccoon, too. Don't mess with the raccoons.
Do not. Scarier than any ghost.
Absolutely.
Joshua, thanks so much for calling in. Let's go next to Amy in Montpelier. Amy, go ahead.
Hi.
Hi there.
Whenever my husband and I go on vacation, we try to book at least one allegedly haunted hotel. And so a few years back, we stayed at the Oxford Hotel in Denver, Colorado. And allegedly, a woman who was cheating on her husband and the lover were shot in their room by the husband some time ago, like in the 1800s or 1900s, early 1900s. And the woman allegedly haunts that room. Well, my husband and I didn't ask for that room, but we did get a room that was a couple doors down from the room. And overnight, the woman allegedly does not like males, and she will pull the covers off of them or tickle their feet or things like that. And at one point, we felt a really cold, like, breeze come over us while we were in bed. And I was asleep, and I was actually afraid to open my eyes because I could also hear, like, somebody whispering, but I couldn't tell what they were saying. And so I woke my husband up, and turns out his sock was, like, across the room, and he wore his socks to bed. And this would not ever just happen because he's got size 14 feet, and we can't find socks that, like, fit him, so they stay on really well. So it was just really creepy to wake up and have him barefoot on one foot and then have that breeze kind of come over us.
Oh, my gosh. The case of the flying sock. Lindsay, have you heard of anything like this?
I haven't, but I have heard of that ghost story before. So it's awesome that, you know, somebody has actually experienced something like that. And what I love, too, is, you know, of course, I'm going to have experiences because I do this. Like, I go out and I'm looking for it. I think it's so awesome for other people to have experiences, you know, not expecting, obviously, like, she's sleeping in her bed, you know? She didn't expect it. So, like, the fact that it happened randomly out of the blue, you know, I would say that was probably a pretty legitimate thing that happened there.
Well, Amy, thank you so much for calling in. Let's go next to Pam in Burlington. Pam, go ahead.
Hi. This story happened about 21 years ago. My daughter was then 2.5, and my sister was moving back to Vermont, so my ex-husband and I were checking out some houses for sale, and we were at an old farmhouse just off the highway up on a hill in Highgate, and we were looking around, and it didn't really suit the family's needs, but we were getting ready to leave, and my young daughter was standing at the bottom of the stairs talking to someone. And I'm saying, come on, let's go. And she goes, I'm talking to the lady. And I went and I got her and looked up the stairs, and there was nobody there. And as we were leaving, I mentioned this to the real estate agent. She said, oh, yeah, don't tell anyone, but this place is haunted.
Wow. Do you think that, Lindsay, do you think that children are oftentimes more aware of these types of stories or events that are happening around them?
Yeah, you know, they are. They're definitely more sensitive. It's like their brains haven't been formed yet, so they're so open to, you know, experiences and everything because, you know, as we grow up and we get older, you know, you just see what's normal in life, what's not. Like, kids are just so innocent, you know, so they definitely, I had some experiences with my own children having imaginary friends that I realized I don't think they were so imaginary.
Really?
So, absolutely. And living in haunted houses, too, you know, like, I love these stories.
Well, we have more to come, but let me reintroduce you first. We're speaking right now with Lindsay Stevens of Rutland. She's an investigator with the Paranormal Investigators of New England. Let's go next to Kermit in Windham. Kermit, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. One winter in 97, something like that. I was in Jamaica at a friend's house. It's a real historic it's had generations of the same family living.
Kermit, are we talking Jamaica, Vermont, or Jamaica, the country?
Vermont. And it was a moonlit night, and I just remember having a hard time sleeping, and then I was just certain that someone was watching me, and I wasn't in my own house, so maybe I was a little bit, you know, uneasy anyway, but I just had the distinct feeling that someone was in the room and watching me. And eventually, I ended up having a conversation, I thought, with a young lady, and I don't remember all the details at this point, but I remember just like kind of feeling like I couldn't decide if I was dreaming or not. And I told everybody about what I dreamt or thought I dreamt. It was so realistic in the morning, and it turned out, and this is the first I'd ever heard of it, that my friend Amos, it was his, you know, it's his family's house, he had a sister that died of leukemia, and that was her. I mean, she told me her name.
Wow.
That was just weird.
Wow. Well, Kermit, thanks for calling in. Lindsay, does this story follow the path of others that you've heard before, of a family member who remains?
Absolutely. I mean, that's what got me into investigating to begin with, was an experience I had with a past family member in my own home. So, you know, I definitely think that plays a role. Also, what I want to add too is just from his story and the previous caller's story is the sensitivity. You know, like, people don't think that they're actually sensitive, but I think sensitive, you're thinking of like psychics, mediums. Well, that's exactly what happened in his situation, though. He was sleeping and he had that feeling. He felt, you know, that there's something watching him. Same with the previous caller. You know, so I think a lot of people are more sensitive than what they really realize, because that definitely plays a key role in investigating and, you know, experiencing things.
Mm. Well, thanks so much for sharing that, Kermit. And I'm loving all of these stories all across the region. Let's go next to Middlebury with Misha. Misha, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. So my story is, I was working in Chicago, and it was about 2008, and I was staying at a Marriott across the street from where the office was where I was working. And it was a Tuesday morning, and I was laying in bed. I was sleeping on my side, and I was trying to decide whether or not. It was like 6 in the morning. I was thinking, do I get up now? I was sort of half asleep, half awake, kind of in that dream state. And then I felt something step up on the bed. It didn't feel like an adult. It felt like either a child or an animal. And all of a sudden, I was on my side, and I froze. And all of a sudden, there was this cold air blowing back and forth in front of my body and my face. It felt like forever, but it was probably around 10 seconds. And then all of a sudden, I opened my eyes, and it stopped, just like that. Mm-hmm. And it freaked me out, so I told the hotel. I said, I need to switch to another room. I told them there was something wrong with the shower because I thought they would think I was a nutcase. And they said, well, do you want to stay on the same floor? I said, no, move me to another floor. And because I thought if the ghost was going to try to find me again, I'd make him work for it. So that's my story.
Well, thank you, Misha, for calling in. That gust of cold air seems to be a
Absolutely.
Trend.
Absolutely. It's another thing of, just like I was just saying with like the energy of, you know, that feeling that people are having. It's the same thing with the cold energy. You know, it's like if all these stories have these same little key things in them, then at that point, like, you have to say, like, something's up, you know?
Mm. So say one of these events or these, somebody gets a feeling and they're in their own home. Do you have any tips for somebody who might want to look around and investigate?
Contact paranormal investigators of New England.
Don't do it yourself.
So this is what I say with doing it yourself. You know, the biggest thing is protection. I don't ever, there's a couple different theories and, you know, aspects of this. One, people can become obsessed. So they, if you're going to become obsessed in like just in trying to find something in your home, and we've seen this time and time again, you know, you can end up drawing stuff into it. You know, if you're like manifesting that energy, then you can end up drawing something. So, you know, boundaries, that's why I always say, like, it is better to have somebody else investigate your own home rather than doing it yourself. However, you know, as long as you try to set the boundaries, I would just say, you know, a voice recorder is going to be your best friend.
Interesting.
That's out of every piece of equipment we have, a voice recorder, which is so simple, you know, it's such a simple piece of equipment, it always gets the most evidence. And you can't say, like, you really can't deny, if you're in a silent room, you know, with multiple people, nobody's making a noise, and you replay your voice recorder and there's something on it, and it's none of your voices, you know, like, that's a great piece of evidence, you know, that I think would be my top. So, you know, investigating your own home, I would just say beware, you know, beware. And if you end up, you know, finding yourself becoming obsessive over it, then you need to step back and, you know, maybe call in somebody else.
Interesting. I really like that point you're making there, Lindsay, about how, you know, these stories can be so fascinating. And you know, while some people might believe them, some people might not. Either one is okay, but there is still this tendency to go too deep down a rabbit hole, no matter, you know, which of those camps that you're in, where you just don't stop thinking about it.
Absolutely. And another thing, too, like you were just saying, some people believe, some people don't. Members of our team, we have people that started on our team that were non-believers. They were complete skeptics, and that's why they joined our team, was because, you know, they wanted to figure it out, you know, because whether you believe or not, I feel like most people have had that level of curiosity.
Mm. Well, Lindsay Stevens, an investigator with the Paranormal Investigators of New England, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And I don't know if you've conjured any ghosts, but you certainly conjured a lot of callers.
I know. It just shows how interesting the subject is, you know?
It really is. Do you like being scared on Halloween? Maybe you hate it. Maybe you love it. Have you ever wondered why exactly that might be? Well, the kids podcast that we make right here at Vermont Public, But Why, recently tackled the question of why we like to feel scared, or at least why some of us like getting scared. Here to help us understand our own weird human psychology is the host of But Why, Jane Lindholm. Jane, welcome.
Thanks. It's nice to be here, Michaela.
I know. Does it feel like coming home a little bit?
Yes, but it's weird to be on the other side of the table.
So, being scared, I kind of hate it. I don't know how you feel about it.
Not a fan.
Okay. All right. Why did you decide to tackle this subject?
Well, I would not have chosen to tackle this subject, but the format of the show is that kids from around the world send us questions, and then Melody Baudette and Kiana Haskin and I go off and find answers to their questions. And a lot of kids have sent us questions about fear, including why we sometimes like scary things like haunted houses and roller coasters and scary movies. And so we found a guy who we thought could help us, and we asked him, first of all, just to explain how kids might understand his research.
My kid would probably tell other kids that her dad does research on play and on fear.
Yeah, so research on play and on fear, and she would be right that that's what her dad does. His name is Mark Anderson, and he's the co-director of a place called the Recreational Fear Lab.
That's a real place?
It's a real place. It's actually connected to Aarhus University in Norway, and I had to spend a lot of time on the interwebs learning how to actually say Aarhus.
I see your pronouncer has three H's.
Yes, it's not Aarhus or our house, it's Aarhus University. But yeah, so he works at the Recreational Fear Lab.
Wow. Okay, so what did he tell you about fear?
Well, one thing that was kind of surprising to me is that he actually says fear is the most studied human emotion, and there's a lot known about it. So there are a lot of things that we don't know about the human psychology and human psyche, but we know a lot about fear. It's a survival instinct. It helps us avoid danger, and if we can't avoid danger, it helps prepare our body to fight or flee. So when you start to feel fear, which is an imminent threat, your heart rate changes, your breathing rate changes, you might sweat more, but you also might feel chills. You can blink more if something is right in front of your face. Your blink rate may go up, and you can have the hair stand up on the back of your neck and on other parts of your body. And one thing to point out, Michaela, is that fear is actually different than anxiety. So fear, as I said, is a response to an imminent threat, something that is going to happen or could happen. And Mark Anderson said anxiety is a worry about something that hasn't yet happened, may not ever happen. So he differentiates between the two.
What if you're like me and you're just caught in a constant loop between both?
Of anxiety and fear. I think many of us are. And actually, Mark Anderson would say part of the problem is continually being scared too much can put you into an anxiety loop, and that is not a good thing.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so please tell me why some people actually do enjoy fear, because it just sounds terrible.
Well, and we could talk about this a little bit later if you want, Michaela, but Mark Anderson says we all like fear. So you and I say we don't, and I've been rethinking that since this interview. But for people who actually enjoy things like haunted houses and scary movies, Mark says that, namely, this is because it gives us a chance to actually practice fear in a controlled environment. So we know we're actually safe, but we can kind of stimulate our brains.
When you see a horror movie that you think is manageable, you got scared, but you didn't get that scared, then those are the movies that we typically find people enjoy the most. And we think that has to do with people's ability to learn from the movie. Sometimes they can learn, you know, how to cope with a very scary situation. Like, what should I do when a loud noise comes? Well, maybe I can hold my ears. They might learn how it feels to be scary. They might learn how a chill running down your spine feels. There's a lot of things that children and adults don't really get to experience a lot. So we don't get to practice it a lot. And fear is one of them. And that's why it can be really fun and interesting to try to feel fear in situations where you still think that you can manage it.
So the Scream movies are actually educational.
That's right. Yeah, for all of those of you out here who really like those kinds of movies, you can tell people it's good for me. It's for my mental health. It's
learning.
Actually a good thing. Yeah.
So how much is too much? There must be a line.
There is a line, and it's different for everybody. So your line and my line are very different from the lines of my children, who both really like scary things. Like, I am way, way farther on the don't scare me line than my 7 and 9-year-old are. But the studies that Mark Anderson and his team are doing show that it's moderate amounts. It's an amount that you say, that was scary but fun. That's good. And too much is not good, because it can, as I said, give you that anxiety, make you too scared, make your heart rate go up too much. You don't enjoy any piece of it. And that's how I feel about most scary movies. Like, I don't enjoy any part of this from start to finish. That's not good. And they actually tested this by having people come out of haunted houses, and it, like, they monitored their heart rates and their self-reflected reactions to it. And it's important work commercially, because the horror industry really wants to know what to do with this. Like, how scary should a movie be? And sometimes people say the scarier the better, but that's actually not true. There is a sweet spot for everybody. And so they're working on trying to help horror industry people figure this out too, so they can get that right level of fear.
Oh, fascinating. That what you're describing also reminds me, Jane, of something that you told our station about recently, a haunted walk or a scary mm-hmm. walk somewhere in Addison County, where they have different versions of the walk for people depending on how scared you are. One is ostensibly for younger kids, but maybe also for
pretty adults cats like me. Like yes. us. Yeah, it's great, because also you're doing it in the daylight, so you can see where the scares are. And then for people like me, I go through again as it gets dark, and it's a little scarier, but I kind of know what's coming, and that's good enough for me.
Okay, so what if you don't like fear at all?
Yeah, so I feel like I'm in that camp. It sounds like maybe you are too, Michaela.
Yes, don't know why you get that sentence. I'm just reiterating
like
it over and over.
Got
no
it.
One scared me.
I don't really like haunted houses. The daylight trail walk was about enough for me. I mean, I can do it at night too. But and I can only sometimes gear myself up for something like a roller coaster. Like, I don't even really love roller coasters or rides that are going to be scary. Also, they make me sick, which is another big piece of that. And I asked Mark Anderson that in our interview. Like, well, I'm not a person who likes fear. And he said, well, those aren't the only ways to experience safe fear. I mean, it was a kid's show, so he gave us some kid-friendly options. But he was like, you know, maybe you're someone who likes a Disney movie. Disney movies can be scary. The start of Bambi can be pretty scary. So maybe that's your level. Or maybe you like the rides that are not quite as scary but are sort of scary. Or as an adult, you might like thrillers but not horror, because they still give you that feeling of suspense and fear, but they don't scare the crud out of you. And he says there are ways to feel that little shiver of fear and excitement, and maybe it's good. And since we did this interview, I've been thinking about, well, where do I do that? And there, like, I run at night a lot, and it's scary sometimes. I have a lot of irrational fear about animals just outside of my headlamp light that are watching me. But I still do it, and I work on mastering that fear and doing that kind of scary thing, because I can practice, like, well, what would I do if a rabid raccoon came out? And so I think you may also find that there are some levels of controlled fear that aren't haunted houses that work for you.
And as we heard at the beginning of the show, Bigfoot is out there.
That's right. So you may want to go on a search for Bigfoot or some other cryptid.
So why exactly would people want to do this and kind of make themselves experience fear?
Right. Why bother if you don't like it? Well, Anderson says that experiencing sort of small levels of fear can be helpful in a couple of ways. They allow you to react better in a real fear situation, essentially because you've kind of practiced it. Like, you've figured out, what would I do, or how would I scream, or what is my body going to do in a scary situation, and how am I going to feel, so that you're not also then surprised by your heart rate. And his lab is actually working on, well, what are the mental and physical benefits of fear? And are kids who are exposed to controlled fear, or who play with fear a lot, are they going to be better off and have a somewhat of an inoculation against anxiety and depression? And he thinks that maybe they do. And some of the studies that his lab is working on suggest that that's also true for adults.
Oh. We did one study during the Corona pandemic, where in large parts of the world there was a lockdown, and during the beginning of the pandemic a lot of adults were very scared. But we found out in a study that horror fans were actually less stressed out by this new virus that was roaming the world than non-horror fans were. So that study indicated that seeing a lot of horror movies and getting scared a lot in a fun way can actually sort of help you deal with stress, or you might not react as much as other people do because you've practiced when you have seen all your scary movies.
Yeah. So, I mean, I thought that was interesting that was a finding they found from the beginning of the COVID pandemic.
That is so interesting. So, are you going to do it? Are you going to start watching horror movies?
No, but the things like running in the dark, I feel like, okay, maybe the fear is worth it. It's helping me practice something, maybe. I don't know. I mean, what about you? Are you going to do something? Or can you think of an area where you feel fear that actually might be helpful?
I think the most I could do is go trick-or-treating with my kid tonight and see some 9-year-olds dressed up as skeletons. That's enough for me right now, but maybe it's a first step.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, my 9-year-old is dressing as an inflatable dinosaur, and when he was 4, he was so scared of those costumes he ran into the field. So see, conquering your fear can be a good thing.
Is this the same inflatable dinosaur that was featured on the But Why Instagram page?
May or may not have been. Don't tell my child I wore his Halloween costume.
Do you like that plug that I just
got in there? Thank you.
Well, Jane Lindholm, the host and executive producer of our kids podcast, But Why at Vermont Public, thank you so much for joining us. This was so fun.
Thank you for inviting
me. Stay with us for here.
All right. And you can go to www.butwhykids.org to find this full episode on being scared and all the other cool things going on over at But Why. And by the way, while you're there, you should check out their new But Why fan club, where you can get special access to newsletters and events and books and merch and all this cool stuff. All this stuff. All right, that is all the time that we have for today. Tomorrow on Vermont Edition, we're going to be sharing the first of a 2-part broadcast of Recognized, a special series from the podcast Brave Little State. Today's show was directed by James Stewart and produced by Tedra Meyer, Andrea Lorien, and Eric Ford. Our call screener today was Rick Barrett, and our theme music was composed by Myra Flynn. I'm Michaela Lefrak. Thanks so much for listening. Happy Halloween, and we'll catch up again soon. Who you gonna call? Ghostbusters! I can't hear you. Who you gonna call?